My name is Richard Gilman Opalski, and I'm associate professor here at UIS in the Department of Political Science. And it is my great honor and pleasure to introduce all of you this evening to Dr. Michael Parenti.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Pleasure to be here. I was going to talk about, what was the title of this talk? Capitalism versus reality. And what I meant was I was going to criticize, and I am going to criticize, the dominant ideologies that hold the system upon us. The dominant orthodoxy today is that the free enterprise system, or capitalism as we know it, has given us democracy, and it has given us prosperity. I want to argue that it has given us neither of those two things. In fact, democracy, both economic and political democracy, emerged not along with the growth and accumulation of wealth and capital, but in reaction to it, in resistance to it. The Constitution itself is a document born of that struggle. The founding fathers or framers or delegates to Philadelphia in 1787, those founders who put together and wrote the Constitution, they were rich merchants, they were bankers, landowners, and more than one third of them were slaveholders. Who else, I ask you, who else could spend 4 months in Philadelphia from May to the middle of September 1787 writing a constitution? The dirt farmer can't do that. The servant in the household servant can't do that. The slave working in the field can't do that. He can't even leave his plantation. Who can do that? Only the rich and the well-born, as they called themselves. That's Alexander Hamilton's statement, that the country should be led by the rich and the well-born, meaning us guys. And all the other guys, us, yeah, that's right. They didn't exactly say it that way. But what you had at this convention, and if you go to Philadelphia, this convention hall is still preserved, you know, to this day, or been restored. What you had there was one individual named James Madison. And what Madison did was during the convention, he kept taking notes. And at night, the other guys would go off to an inn or something. He'd go back to his room, and he would transcribe the notes. So we have this remarkable document, Madison's Notes on the Constitutional Convention. I read the whole thing and went through the whole thing, in which these people, thinking they are speaking in secret, because they got the windows sealed off, the room closed in. Imagine the middle of Philadelphia summer, sealing off the rooms with all these delegates jammed in there. And they are putting together a constitution in secrecy. Madison records their remarks, and he joins in. He says, the common people are not to be trusted, and the common people are irresponsible. He moved a little bit more over to Jefferson's side on that. He loosened up a little on that in the next couple of years. But most of the people there, of course, did not change. Those who own the land should rule it. That was John Jay who said that one. So they don't pull any bones about it. They don't make any bones. They pretty much come right out and say what it is. Madison, again, in Federalist Paper number 10, which he published out to the public, the most common and durable source of faction, and by faction he didn't just mean little groups or cliques breaking up, he meant class factions, farmers against merchants, against bankers or something like that. The most common and durable source of faction is the various and unequal distribution of property. And by property, he doesn't mean land. Today, when we say property, we usually mean a couple of acres you have there in the house. Property was another word for wealth. So they were the people who had wealth. Democracy, as they saw it, was dangerous, and by definition, it was excessive. Democracy was something that led to mob rule. The working poor are riffraff. The Constitution, brothers and sisters, was and is a filtered system. What does it filter? Popular sentiment, popular input, ruled by the common folks. Get a look at your Constitution. You cannot vote for the U.S. president. Nobody has ever voted for an American president. You can only vote for electors in your state. And if those electors of one party win a majority of the vote, they then cast their votes for that president. That's the way it's still working. You're not literally voting for the man. You're voting for an electoral college in your state. That was done because they wanted to filter out the passions of the people. And the passions of the people, and the people were not all crazed and impassioned and outraged about this, that, or the other thing. But they saw people who wanted to challenge us, people who said your property is too much, too fast, too dishonest, too exploitative, we won't stand for it. That's what they saw as wild mob rule and all that, meaning people who are agitating and fighting against their interests and against the injustices that have been perpetrated on them. Senators, nobody, if the Constitution that they set up, nobody could elect senators. The U.S. senators were elected by the state legislators. So again, another filter between what the people want and what was their, how it impact on the rulers. It wasn't until 1917 with an amendment to the Constitution that we now vote directly for senators, U.S. senators. The Supreme Court, nobody has ever voted for a member of the Supreme Court. He's appointed by the president, and he serves for a lifetime. That is not democracy. That's oligarchy. That's ruled by a few who are unaccountable to anyone else. Then they got to the last part of government, which was the House of Representatives. And that's when finally a few people got up and said, James Wilson of Pennsylvania, Benjamin Franklin of Pennsylvania, Colonel Mason of Virginia, that was a surprise, Mason University in Virginia, it exists, it's named after him. They got up and they said, look, we got to leave something for the people. They got to be connected to this Constitution. If we block it all out for ourselves, it's not going to get passed and be ratified. So but that fight to get direct representation from the House of Representatives really brought it out in these delegates. They started coming out and talking about the people are riffraff, the people are this, and the people are mindless, and they don't know how to rule themselves, and they need our leadership, and all that sort of stuff. As it was, this Constitution was so completely undemocratic, since it was a concoction of the rich, that it wasn't getting accepted. It wasn't being ratified by the various states. To get it ratified by the states began to ratify the Constitution with a stipulation saying, we will accept this U.S. Constitution and take it on the U.S. government as long as you add human rights to the people. And that's when Madison got down there and he wrote the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, which we know as what? The Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights, and that very first amendment is the people shall have the right to peaceful assemble and to have freedom of whatever they want to say and their religious rights and so forth and such. Never said that we have to have religions or we institute any religion in there. Not at all. But, well, let me, enough on the Constitution. That gives you an idea that how qualified our rights were in those days. Let me say something else about the ideology of wealth and how it protects a class system. Wealth and privilege rarely stand naked. Wealth is usually enshrouded in the legitimating myths that treat this or that social order as the natural order. Chinese landlords in feudal China, William Hinton wrote about this in his book, Fan Shen. He lived in China right in the middle of the Chinese Revolution, too. The Chinese landlords used to have a saying that they used to tell the peasants who worked and half-starved themselves so that the landlord couldn't live good and well and wastefully and whatever else. And the saying was that the sun cannot rise in the west. See, the sun, you can no more rule and run things and push me aside and try to live without me. You can no more rule than can the sun rise in the west instead of coming from the east. And so it is. That's what capitalism gives us today in the ideology that is promulgated. It gives us these mythologies that it fosters democracy. And I was trying to tell you that those of wealth and property and control did not push for democracy. They talked about democracy the way many of the ancient Romans did, as a dangerous thing, a mob rule, a proletarian rabble, and so forth. And I forget where am I? Doesn't matter. I'm getting there. Okay. Two basic things to keep in mind about democracy. First, it's not a system born of a blueprint. Rather, it emerged in imperfect fits and starts from the field of political struggle, most usually class struggle. In other words, it's not a Grecian urn that comes to us from the Greeks, from Athens, and says, this is democracy, and now we will do it, and we will use it. It's a very messy struggle thing, and it's very closely related to class struggle, from the contest between those who possess wealth and property against those who do not. This said, the second consideration becomes evident. Democracy is more than a form of governance. It also has a substantive dimension. So I make a distinction between procedural democracy and substantive democracy, or to put it more bluntly, electoral democracy and economic democracy. We hear that the free market provides for us. We should try and depend on the free market, which is one of the great gifts of capitalism, we're told. Well, we did. We've done it all through most of our history. We've depended on the free market. In 1900, I say the free market, I call it 1900. Because you look back at 1900, there were no government regulations to speak of, no minimum wage, no limit on the workday. Workers were sometimes forced to work 12 hours, 14 hours, 15, 16 hours. Kids had to work. 8-9-year-old kids worked in factories in 1900. That was your free market at work. Unregulated, free to do what you want. No minimum wage. No occupational safety. No consumer protections. You used to eat meat that was diseased and rancid, and people got sick from it. Upton Sinclair, he documented that in his book, The Jungle. And that was well after 1900, too. No consumer protections, no public education in most communities, no hygienic regulations, no housing safety standards. So let the free market take care of that. So that was your free market. That was the democracy. The struggle for democracy, the actual struggle for democracy, does not go back to Franklin or James Madison or Hamilton or those people. It goes back over 2,500 years ago, long before the Philadelphia Convention. Democracy is a wonderful invention by the people of history who were seeking to defend themselves from the greed and the abuses of wealth. That's what democracy was. Time and again, it comes up as a weapon to be used against the privileges and abuses of wealth. That's what it was in Athens in the 6th century BC, when Cleisthenes got up and ruled and had popular resistance and forces that came along with him to say, we want public control, we want public assemblies, we want to rule. The Hoplites, do you know, anybody here know who the Hoplites were? They were Athenians. They were Athenian people. They were farmers, though. And they were the guys who had enough money, I don't know how much money, whatever, I had enough property, small holders. They were small holders who could buy a shield and a broadsword and serve in the infantry, the Athenian infantry. And they put up one of the first stinks with Cleisthenes going along with it. Cleisthenes was an aristocrat. He should have been on the other side with the rich guys. He was one of these aristocrats who sided with the people and was a democrat. He believed in democracy. Cleisthenes had one of his young lieutenants, one of the best guys we're fighting. He was also a member of his same family, from the same aristocratic family, and he became known as the most famous democratic leader in Greek history, and his name was Pericles. We all in grad school had to read Pericles' monumental statement to the Athenian people and all that. So the hoplites, these small farmers, said, we want to vote. We want an assembly. We want to make decisions. If we're going to have to fight these wars, we want to be able to vote on whether we can or whether we want to and whether we don't and whether it really serves our interests and whether it doesn't. And that led to this remarkable thing called the Popular Assembly, where people just had lots, and any week maybe 10 of you might have drawn lots, which said you got to take 2 days in the assembly and listen to these cases and vote on them. And then there's rotation, you know. All of Athens that were not in servitude, that were free citizens, served. That was a system of democracy. That system, by the way, was really resented by Plato and Socrates. You know, you read Plato's dialogues, and he's got Socrates always talking about, look, a cobbler, a shoemaker, should make shoes. He could concentrate on that. That's his gift. Whereas the statesman, which would be one of his rich friends who was out there, the statesman shall rule the state. And everybody in their little spot, the laundry lady will do the laundry, and this person will do that, and all that. And in other words, people should not come out of their little roles and think that they can have a say in ruling themselves. So Socrates was not somebody, I don't adore him quite as much as some of my colleagues in political science do. And there were important issues. They fought over land holdings, wages, rents, debts, taxes, food, the fear of leveling. For Plato makes the point, Socrates makes the point too, that the people who are doing these drudgy jobs should not show up the next week in the assembly. They should just keep doing these jobs. In Sparta, they all love Sparta. In Sparta, those people are helots. They're slaves. And that's the way we want. That's the way we really want it. So the next time your political philosophy teacher tells you, you don't teach political philosophy, do you, Richard? Oh, I'm sorry. But I know he's a Democrat. I know he is. He's Cleisthenes. He's one of those liberals. Huh? A liberal? How do you like that? You're going to hold it against him? No, you can't do that. The struggle, there's something I want to say about the struggle for democracy and how it's against wealth, not wealth coming along, capitalism coming along, and freeing everybody to use it, is that the pursuit of economic justice is what leads to the expansion of democratic rights. U.S. workers in the 1820s and the 1830s in America waged, state by state, they waged, male workers, this was. Unfortunately, it was limited to white male workers, but it was a step in a direction to fight for the right to vote. Not because they particularly were interested in voting, but what they wanted was a better wage, a wage that they could live with. To get that wage, they had to pressure the bosses. To pressure the bosses, they had to form what were called combinations. But combinations, what today we call unions, but they were called combinations. Combinations, almost every judge in America declared them illegal and out of the way. So to get the right to a combination, you needed to start electing judges. To elect judges, you had to participate in campaigns. To participate in campaigns, you had to have the right to talk. You had to have the right to speak. You'd see organizers would come out into towns and hold leaflets up and all, and the sheriff would come and others would come, and bailiffs would beat them up and throw them in jail. So the workers actually had to fight for free speech in order to organize, in order to fight politically, in order to get these material gains of a decent wage and on, and something better, a better life, a better wage, the right to organize combinations. They had to change the law. So in the pursuit of economic democracy, challenging dominant class interests, they end up expanding political democracy. The expansion of political democracy becomes a tool, a more imperfect and inadequate tool for gains, as, for instance, with the New Deal and such. So with the struggle for civil rights waged by African Americans. If you read the older African American civil rights leaders, even before Martin Luther King, you know, people like William White and the others, and NAACP and such, they talked about segregation, of course, and Jim Crow and the terrible oppression of it, but they also were hitting bread and butter issues like jobs, housing, protection from police abuse, protection from lynch mob rule, decent living conditions, wages and such. Gains have to be made. An end of mass incarceration, as today is a blooming issue, as you know, mass incarceration, people getting arrested because a blinker on their car is broke or something, or their driver's license has expired a month ago or something. That's me, by the way. So almost didn't make it here. The same with women and the right to vote and such. The right to vote among women was not merely a gender competition of, well, you men have it, so we women should have the right to vote. Women had very real injustices facing them. If a woman inherited something from her father, she gets married, her husband owns it. They couldn't own property. In one thing after another, they faced very real oppressions in work, in pay, in family, inheritance rights, education, personal safety, reproductive rights, all of which they are still fighting for. And as you can see with this new Congress here, waging war on Planned Parenthood and the like. So what we should do is notice, is observe that there's a close relationship between capitalism and democracy, an antagonistic relationship, a conflicting one. Historically, corporate capitalists have had a hard time dealing with democracy. They have opposed almost every democratic advance, the elimination of property qualifications for voting and office holding. The very super rich in America opposed eliminating that. The freedom of an independent press, they opposed that. To this day, they opposed it. The airwaves are the property of the people of the United States, yet the airwaves are licensed out to these big, rich corporations and companies, Fox and CNN and such, and they're controlled by people who have a particular view and who have the money to buy and hold all that airtime. Freedom of an independent press, the right to collective bargaining. We're still fighting, breaking unions today as ever. Living wage. They opposed direct elections of office holders. They are still opposing and suppressing voters' registration, making it hard to register. You go to a working guy and say, you got to go to the county office to register before you can vote. Well, the county office is 25 miles away. It's 25 miles there, 25 back. He's just worked a long day. He probably can't even get there before it closes. So he ends up not voting. And it's a way of doing what the framers were trying to do, as you see, which is suppress and make it difficult for the ordinary people, the poor people, to qualify to vote and to participate in this system. They're opposing early voting. Early voting means instead of waiting for that one Tuesday in November, which may not be a day you could even do it, your boss wants you to work 10 hours that day, you can do an early voting earlier in the week. There'll be three early days or something that you could pick, or a whole weekend where you can go and vote. Accessible registration. The Republican Party today is against early voting. It's for fewer polling stations. It's for briefer voting hours and periods. It's calling for two hurdles, a birth certificate and a picture ID, or two picture IDs of official documents. You know, I was just thinking, do I have two official picture IDs of documents? I do, because I happen to have a passport and a driver's license. Well, there's a lot of people, poor people, elderly people, who don't have driver's license, or there are a lot of people who don't have passports. They don't get an opportunity to travel abroad. To defend their unfair privileges and exploitations, the plutocracy is ruled by the wealthy. Democracy is ruled by the demos. The demos in Greek, in the early Greek language, was the people, ruled by the people. So the plutocracy here, the plutocrats sometimes must resort to force and violence, which they do. Labor battles, breaking unions, breaking demonstrations. Consider the coordinated police repression of the Occupy movement. Do you remember, any of you remember the Occupy movement of 4 or 5 years back or so? Yeah. Well, it was 1% versus 99%. And the problem was the 1%, the super rich, had the police on their side, a militarized police that went out there and systematically, in 15 major cities, made war against the occupants. Now, the plutocrats themselves today claim that they are proponents of democracy. They defend democracy. They pretend to be its progenitors, not only at home but abroad. In the last half century, the leading capitalist nations have undermined and destroyed political reformist movements and revolutions in countries throughout Latin America, Central America, Africa, Central Asia, the Middle East, and just about everywhere. In Europe, too, with the destruction of Yugoslavia, which was a social democracy, which President William Clinton bombed for 78 days and nights, and also infected with depleted uranium, so that in Serbia today, cancer is, they have the highest rate of cancer in Serbia, thanks to President Bill Clinton, who was looking after us, doing all that stuff. And they resist democratization not only at home but abroad. They resist reformist governments that pursue egalitarian economic policies, as in Libya and Syria, but they support those autocrats who pursue free market policies. The capitalist state, and that's what we live under a government that works in a capitalist system. The capitalist state has two core functions. The first is to maintain and advance capital accumulation. That is, the companies, the corporations have to keep making their money, and that process of them accumulating wealth has to be protected. And it's being protected very well. In the last 10 years, all the new wealth that has been produced, it is all in its entirety, just about all of it went to the top 1%, 1 or 2%. And when I talk about capitalism and such, I'm talking about the giant corporations. I'm not talking about mom and pop small businesses, because that often always comes up. Someone always raised their hand and says, what about mom and pop small business? What about, you know, mom and pop, and they get a little thing together and they sell nice little this, and they make a little money for themselves, and they hire someone, so they create the job and all that. And small business is actually a source of jobs in America. All I can say is, I'm not talking about them. Lenin was right. He said 10 million small businesses count for nothing. A few giant cartels count for everything. A cartel is like the oil cartel, which would be made up of Exxon and Mobil, and all. They collude together and they divvy out the market and they play with the prices and the like. Small businesses, I call it the squirrels dancing among the elephants. And you know what happens to squirrels would dance among elephants. Have you ever seen it? No, you haven't, but they tend to get smashed and squashed. I think something like, what is it? Is it something, it's over 10,000 small businesses, or maybe it's 5,000, I forget the number now, a week. Thousands of businesses a week go out of business, small business. A lot more open up, maybe, but and it is a source of I've been accused of being soft on small businesses, and that's true, I am. As individuals, capitalism does not usually bring out the best in us. We face too many ugly necessities created by the competitive dog-eat-dog system. Unfortunately, capitalism best rewards the worst part of us: ruthless, competitive, conniving, opportunistic, exploitative, acquisitive drives. Private enterprise, as it's sometimes called, gives little reward and often much punishment, or at least much handicap, to honesty, compassion, many forms of hard work, cooperative and collective effort, love of justice and fair play, and a concern for those most in need. There was a great labor union leader who later became a noted socialist leader, American, named Eugene Victor Debs from Indiana. And Debs remarked with bitter irony that to the extent that that life in an advanced capitalist state is made bearable or decent, barely decent, it's because of the humanizing effects of democratic struggle and labor struggle. Ironically, Debs started figuring all this out while he was in jail. He was leading the railroad strike and all that, and he got beaten up and thrown in jail. I've been beaten up by police and thrown in jail. And let me tell you, when you get slammed in the jail and slammed against the bars and thrown in there and they lock it up, you have time to think, you know. You really sort of sit there and you say, what is going on? What is this all about? Wait a minute. Where's the stars and stripes and all that stuff? Nobody's singing. Nobody's going. And Debs was sitting there and he's saying, this is crazy. Why are the cops on the side of the big bosses? Why aren't the cops out there on the side of the workers? We are the people of society. We're the people who do all those jobs. And then he began to realize that the state is not neutral. That state is not neutral. If there's a disruption and this and that, the state comes out and they start serving the powers that be. Well, but Debs was making this other point, which I thought was very interesting, that the more successful we are, we pull down certain, you know, increases and betterment in wages and this or that and this and that. We make life a little bearable, more bearable. We cut our 14-hour day to a 13-hour day. That's a little bit better, you know. Whatever, we try to make this society more human. We are legitimating it. And what we really should be doing is telling the people, look, this isn't for us at all. This is a society that's heartless and inhumane, and we're making it somewhat a little more humane. We create little patches of community and democratic distribution in which we try to live. Is capitalism not a successful economic system? It has success. It has produced, it's the envy of the world, what we have in America. Well, it really isn't. It depends on your position in the social order. Let's start with capitalist leaders. Nancy Pelosi, Congresswoman, Democratic Party, Speaker of the House, in 2008, at the end of Bush's term, George W. Bush's term, she says, Bush is a complete failure on every policy area. I would argue Bush was a smashing success in almost every policy area. Bush himself didn't hold back in his personal praise. He said, and I think he was right, absolutely right, he said he accomplished everything he could do in the within the strictures of the presidential office, except two things. He failed to undo Social Security. That means pensions, dependency, and disability. That's what Social Security covers. If something bad happens to you, you will not be left to just lie in the street. You do get some support. It's a socialist program. That's socialism at work. And they are dedicated, the conservatives are dedicated to eliminating it every chance they can get, or nibble away at it, or break it down, minimize it. Bush also pointed out that he brought in, well, no, he doesn't point it out. I'm pointing it out, what Bush did. I'm sorry. Bush had provided massive increases in the military budget, a military budget that went from $250 billion to something like $526 billion. Today, under Obama, it's closer to $1 trillion a year. $1 trillion a year. Some of that money comes from the Energy Department. Some of it comes from other things. Some of it comes from these other wars that are then slapped onto this budget as an extra budget. Massive shifts in tax burden from the working class, to the working class and middle classes, tax burden. Cutbacks and defunding and deregulation of human services, including public education and environmental protections. Massive debt, which helps to defund government. Defunds human services. Wait a minute, I've said all that, didn't I? I'm sorry. Kill these programs, not because they don't work, but because they do. That's why they want to get rid of Social Security, not because it doesn't work, but because it does. It's been about the best check on poverty, elderly poverty, that we've had. Capitalism is less successful in the more prosperous countries. That is, a country that is prosperous, like Finland, Norway, Denmark, Sweden. These are the social democracies. After World War II, they faced the Red Army on the Elbe, along the Elbe River. They faced, all of Eastern Europe was now communist. All these communist countries were now providing Social Security, old age pensions, supports, guaranteed right to a job to every worker, free medical care to every worker. This was going on in the communist countries. Subsidized rent and housing. No worker could spend more than, I think it was 15% of his salary on rent. So you were guaranteed, you didn't have to put all your money on your housing. These kind of things were very embarrassing. And after World War II, you had a very strong social democratic parties, including some communists, voting and bringing in governments that did these generous human services for all, more equitable tax system, consumer and worker protections, excellent utility and transportation services, and then all the things I just mentioned about the other social democracies. But social democracies are recent. And they're never really secure. Look what's happened in the United Kingdom. It's rolling back now since Tony Blair. They've been undermining it and cutting it back, and the Brits are paying more and more and getting less and less for it. And there are cutbacks all through Western Europe because there's no more Eastern Europe. There's no more communism. The Red Army's gone. The big communist parties in France and Italy are pretty much gone. So they don't have to, the guys at the top no longer have to make frightened concessions to the mass of the people. In contrast to the social democracies of Western Europe, I mean, they're still pretty good. They're better than what we've got. If you were ill, you're much luckier to be ill in Finland than in the United States. Capitalism is a more complete success in countries like Indonesia, Nigeria, Colombia, El Salvador, places like that. That's where, let's take Indonesia. And by successful, I mean more successful in serving that 1% at the very top. They don't have to kick back for all these regulations and all these human services and such. In Indonesia, there's no customer service or warranties on commodities. Drinking water is privatized and unclean. You have to buy drinking water, and you got to hope it's clean. No public health services, no environmental protections, chaotic auto traffic, regular bus plunges, buses going off because roads are so poorly graded and unfixed, rampant crime, terrible poverty. But the rich, the rich in Indonesia, they live so well. They live in such lush luxury. They have small armies of servants who serve them. And the servants are de facto slaves. And if the servant doesn't want to serve and wants a day off or wants that, he or she can be kicked out. And there'll be five other people waiting at the gate to come in and serve. And so that's the kind of world that the capitalists want, a world of billionaires who can call their shots and the rest of us lining up with bowed head. Capitalism makes a claim not only to democracy, but to prosperity. Not true. The goal is private wealth for the few and public poverty for the many. And that's what I was saying about Indonesia and the like. The poorer and hungrier you are, the harder you will work for less and less, and the more surplus value I, the boss, can extract from you. Free enterprise and competition are widely celebrated as part of the dynamic and abundance of capitalism. In fact, the corporate enterprise system almost always is in a state of crisis. Even in the USA, abnormality is normality. Recessions, 1780s, terrible recessions, terrible fights about rent, land rents and taxes and such. It led to Shays' Rebellion, and Shays' Rebellion led to the Constitutional Convention. They hurried together to whip together a stronger government to stop this kind of thing. 1805, panic. 1820s, recessions. 1850, market crashes. 1873, a whole decade of depression. Another whole decade, 1890s, Teddy Roosevelt, 1896, saying, this country needs a war, any war. And he got it in 1898, which was what? The Spanish-American War. 1920s were a recession time. I never learned that. We always learned the 1920s were what? The jazz age, right? The roaring 20s, they were called. Charleston. With very little inducement from you, I can do the Charleston, right? But I won't. This went on through the whole 1920s. You know where the recession was in the 1920s? It was mostly in rural areas, which is probably why it could go undetected. But in the rural areas, it was very hard on people, both black and white. Then at the end of that decade, in October 1929, came the great crash of the stock market, and the depression came. That depression lasted from 1929 to 1941. It ended in 41-42 because the U.S. was now in a major global war against Japan and Germany. And 1941, this is where you got to take a look more closely, because this explains the great American prosperity, and it did come around that time. I remember my uncle Nick and my dad and my uncle Joe all talking and moaning about how the war is going to be over fairly soon. I think it was coming, like, the Germany was just about falling and Japan was, they were waiting for them to surrender. And we're going to be hit with a terrible depression again. I said, why? I always used to hear about this thing called the depression. You're surprised to know I was even alive then. I look so young, don't I? You thought I was like, like 35 or 40, I know. Okay, yeah, right. They understood that 9 million young American men and some tens of thousands of women are going to come back out of uniform and come back into the economy, there's going to be no jobs. Where are all the jobs going to be? See, there were, the Depression ended in 1941 because the U.S. was ready to really spend. They spent deficit spending. They spent enormous amounts of money to do in war what they would never do in peace, which was to build all these planes and tanks and whatever else. But when the war was over, these 9 million of these people who came back entered the GI Bill of Rights, GI Bill. The GI Bill was a tremendous program. It brought it to every veteran from the war could go back to school, and he would get a full stipend and a full payment of his tuition fees also, a scholarship. And or others could start small businesses, and others could do all sorts of other kinds of things. It turned out to be one of the most economically terrific things. GI veterans who hadn't finished high school were now becoming accountants or going on into other professions. It actually enriched the whole economy terrifically. Another thing that happened was all during the war, people like my Uncle Nick, who used to make $50 a week as a garage mechanic, was now, he quit being that during the war, and he went to work in a war factory, and making planes and this and that. So you had people now doing all this kind of work, and coming away with lots of money. The trouble is they had nothing to buy. I remember that too during the war. Everything was rationed. So you had all this money now, but you couldn't buy. The factories were no longer making electric toasters or refrigerators or cars or anything like that, or houses. The factories were making planes and tanks, and you couldn't buy a tank. You didn't have much use for a tank anywhere. But so you had this immense backlog of buying power. And that's really one of the problems of recessions is, of course, you haven't paid your workers enough money to buy back the goods and services that they're producing. And that's why you have a recession. So all of that was changing, the GI Bill and then this. From 1947 to, I would say, 1979, 1981, during the last 2 years of Carter, where he started selling out, and the introduction of Ronald Reagan coming in, up until that time, that's the immense prosperity you got, building of suburbia, building of highways, the kind everything you see and take for granted now, freeways and highways, all those things, they didn't exist back when I was graduating from school. When we heard that the Pulaski Highway in Jersey, did you hear about it? You can go 60 miles an hour. Wow, 60 miles an hour. Yeah, a mile a minute. Well, that's only 60 miles an hour. What's so fast about that? We learned later on as more and more cars came out and this and that. So there was this kind of backlog of consumer hunger, a consumer hunger that's backed by money, by ability to buy for it. That became the basis of the great prosperity, a prosperity which is now eluding us, a prosperity which is declining and declining. You hear reports about 20,000 more new jobs, people, but they don't tell you about the quality of the jobs, the paying of the jobs, the durability of it. As part of the myth of prosperity, the Horatio Alger myth, as you know it, the view that every generation is more prosperous than the previous one, it just isn't so. In the last 20 years, all the new wealth created went to the top 2 or 3% in the last 20 years. The rest of us have worked harder and stayed much in the same place. And if you're working harder and harder to stay in the same place, you're not staying in the same place. You know, you're being extracted. Our national debt is greater and greater. It's up to, what, $17 trillion now? We, the taxpayers, owe that. The national debt belongs to us. Karl Marx made that point in Kapital, Volume 1, where he said, of all the things in society, the one thing that belongs to the people is the national debt. They own it. They'll be taxed. They have to pay it. And they pay it to those who own all those U.S. bonds, those national bonds and such, which are the rich. This recession that we've been living in now, the 2008-09 one that's still going on at 2015, these recessions, it's like all recessions, it has certain advantages, not for us, but for the 1%, the people at the very top. It wipes out weaker competitors. It allows mergers at more affordable costs, concentrations. Marx called that, he even had a phrase in, and I'll tell you again, volume 1, chapter 32. Chapter 32 or chapter 23, a lot you care, one capitalist, the phrase was, one capitalist will kill many capitalists. Back in 1910, you had something like, I would say, there must have been 20 or 30 auto factories, auto businesses arising. About 13 of them provided electric cars, believe it or not. The electric cars got wiped out, though, and the others came in. By the great prosperity, we're talking now no longer about businesses, we're talking about giant corporations. You had only three auto companies, right? Ford, Chrysler, who was the third one? General Motors, the biggest, I forgot it. Yeah, General Motors, right, thank you. And that's the way it is with the oil companies. That's the way it was with the meat packing companies. There must have been about 200 meat packing companies to play safe, I'll say by World War I or by 1920, that had broken down to Armour and Swift and one or two others, about four or five of them. I'm thinking of the book, that's the trouble, you can't remember it. The Triumph of Capitalism, who wrote that? No, the Triumph of Conservatism. I'm trying to remember. It was about that turn of the century where the cartels and these few big companies took over. And it happens all the time. I think it happened with computers, didn't it? I mean, there were all sorts of little companies starting up, people's garages and this and that. And then it gets back down to what? Three or four companies, giant companies with billions of dollars. That doesn't mean that these big companies don't take money from the government. They do. They don't want you to take money from the government. They don't want you to get food stamps. They don't want you to get rent subsidies. But they take money. They take billions every year. They take over land, for instance. What the Pentagon does with with some of the large, what? I know, you know, I'm half deaf too, so I can't. McDonnell Douglas, right? Well, they'll give them the land, they'll give them the materials. They can build the factory, and then they can produce whatever new jet or new rocket or new instrument of death is needed. And this is all done compliments of the taxpayers. Okay. The goal of giant global capitalism is the third worldization, not only of the U.S. economy, but of the entire world. I've written books on that. The U.S. global military machine undermines any country, any government, any leader that uses the land, labor, capital, and natural resources for the development of their own country. So we have not only public suppression and impoverishment at home, but we got it around the entire globe with wars, 2, 3, 4 at a time, military bases, hundreds of them around the world. The empire feeds off the republic, the face of imperialism, I called it. $1 trillion a year is spent from the Pentagon budget and related budgets, increasing the deficit into trillions upon trillions. I didn't do much about foreign policy. I was trying to concentrate on the whole ideology of it and such. I advocate socialism when it works and because it works. The post office, it works. They're trying to bust up the post office and they're doing a good job of it now, the Republican Congress is, but it was a very decent kind of thing. It was the It was the largest union workers, a group of union workers in any one, I think, any one enterprise. You could deliver, you still can, deliver for 47 cents, you can deliver a letter from your door to someone 3,000 miles away, or, I'm sorry, we're not in California, someone 1,500 miles away in L.A., for 45 cents, 47 cents, you can do that. Social Security, we've got, and I like that. I think it's fair, it's humane, it's decent. Medicare, when it works against a prohibitive, profit-driven medical and insurance corporations. Public health care for everyone and everything. Housing, transportation, as in France, for instance, or Japan, where they've got these tremendous super monorail trains that go that cannot be derailed, haven't lost a passenger in 10, 15 years, have given out billions of rides and the like. I like that. Public utilities, I find that's better than private utilities. I live in California, and I got PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric. Well, it's the highest rate. It's the highest. They talk about private competition and we're efficient and we give you. Well, they don't do that at all. They charge us the highest rates in America. If you had a public utility, that public utility doesn't spend millions of dollars on advertising. It doesn't spend millions of dollars on its CEO bosses having to be paid 30, 40, 50 million a year. The public utilities are much safer. PG&E got a $45 million handout from the state of California to start checking up on the gas leaks in this whole system of gas, and it didn't do it. It even got, in San Bruno, it got complaints from people who were smelling gas, and it didn't do it. It used that money to wage a proposition campaign, to have a proposition which said that only private utilities can function in California, no public utilities. And they had millions of dollars to spend, and the miracle was that they lost. The people voted against that. The people are interested in socialism, as long as you don't call it socialism and you just give them the benefits and the functions of it. And so what PG&E did was they spent all that money on that campaign. They lost the campaign, but in San Bruno there was an explosion, a gas explosion, a gas leak, and eight people were killed and 40 homes were blasted. I saw photographs of it. I treated it in my book, Profit Pathology, a little bit of a chapter on that. And public education is being destroyed, as we see before our own eyes, where students are having to pay for education when they were supposed to get one that was free with minimal costs. Where professorships are getting wiped out and adjuncts are being used. An adjunct is a teacher who gets paid only by a course, one course here, one there, and all that. Very poorly paid, hard to survive. And this is what's happening. And the money goes to the big administrators and goes to the presidents of the universities and the regents and the like. So you turn the university into something that resembles a private corporation. We hear that we must fix the system. Unfair tax distribution, insufficient health care goes on, low wages, wage theft, all sorts of inequities. But no, some of us argue, the system is fixed. It's rigged already. It is the way they want it to work. As far as they're concerned, these last 10 years haven't been so bad. Hasn't been bad. It's fine. Things are going fine. What are you so upset about? But tell me, and I've had students say, and I'm going to close right here. I've had students say, one time when I was teaching at SUNY, State University of New York, in Albany, the students said, "But socialism? How would it work? It's a dream, isn't it? A dream in theory and a nightmare in practice." That's a phrase I myself coined just to sum it up for their anxieties. You think it's a dream in theory and a nightmare in practice. My students at SUNY, they would say, How would it work? And I would say, well, you're sitting in it right now. You are too, you know. Or less and less, of course, as they privatize it. Better than private colleges on Long Island and more affordable because they raised tuition horribly and privatized private education. And so I'm for that. I'm for real private public education. I'm for real public utilities, for public housing that's affordable and made in a humane fashion, public transportation, public hospitals. So I advocate socialism because it works when it works. Small business, small services, maybe they could also work and have a place there. End the power of these giant corporations. Bring back real democracy and real prosperity. Thank you for your kind attention, folks.